That's a hopeful thing, but it's above my pay grade to say this is evidence for life after death.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Life and Death podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. I'm your host, Stephen Rumford, and after more than two decades of working in palliative care, I'm here to have honest conversations about life, death, and what really matters in the end. Today, I'm joined by Professor Alan Kellier, a sociologist and author who's been challenging how we think about death and dying for decades. Alan is the founder of the Compassionate Communities movement, which encourages all of us, not just healthcare professionals, to play a role in supporting people at the end of life. In this episode, we'll talk about how we can move beyond a purely medical model of dying, maybe how different communities and cultures respond to death, and what a more human and compassionate approach to care would look like. So, Alan, welcome to the Life and Death podcast. Thank you very, very much for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah. Personally, a real delight. I came across your work probably around about at the time that Compassionate Cities, the book, came out. And I think I said this on the introductory email to you. I'd written to you back then in a slightly kind of, oh my goodness, this, I really like this book. I really like what this is saying. And I wrote to you. I was working at St. Joseph's Hospice down in Hackney, East London. And I remember going to my boss at the time saying, this is what we need to do. We need to do something like this. As a physio, I didn't have a great deal of leverage, so I don't think we did. But it certainly has stayed with me, what you said, what you speak about in the book. And I wonder whether we, rather than just starting there, I wonder whether you would be willing to share a little bit of biography, you know, where you're from, as it were, and how you got into both your academic work and particularly the sort of focus on death and dying, where that came from.
So, as listeners will obviously pick up very quickly, I'm an Australian originally, but I've been mainly an academic all my adult life after graduating with my PhD. But I spent the first 10 years of my academic career and beyond, really, but certainly the first 10 years studying dying. That was my major interest. My PhD was the first study I ever did, and it was an interview-based study of 100 people with less than 6 months to live. And so I have a whole series of books, studies, if you like, on the human experience of dying. As we spoke about earlier, I've written History of Dying, and I've written a Social Psychology of Dying, and I've written on mystical experiences around dying or altered states of consciousness around dying. And I've entered the debates around the determination of death, so how we determine how we die. And for those 10 years, people used to say to me, apart from the fact that I was an eccentric, seen as an eccentric sociologist with an interest like this, people said to me, you should go into palliative care. And I said, no, palliative care is not where I belong because palliative care is not interested in dying. And people used to think that was really funny, if not ironic remark, but I wasn't trying to be ironic or funny. The reality is, even today, 90% of palliative care articles in the key international journals are not about dying. In fact, they're on symptom science and they're on health services research. And the job it's supposed to do is care for dying people and their families, other carers, and people living with grief and bereavement. And the problem with that is, except for dying, caregivers and people living with bereavement, it's like a piece of string. It goes on forever. So I created the phrase compassionate community to refer to community development. Mm-hmm. And I've created compassionate cities to refer to social ecology. Now, social ecology and community development and services redesign and civic policy development and health promotion, social marketing, all of these things are a normal part of public health programs in every aspect of not only medicine, but healthcare more broadly. So you'll see public health programs in disability. You'll find public health programs in sexuality, mothers and children's health, trauma medicine, cardiology, and it goes on and on and on. For some reason, for historical reasons, really, palliative care did not develop a public health approach. And it had something to do with the fact that even palliative care had an old-fashioned view of what dying was like. In other words, dying was the last catastrophic moment in a life that lasted a couple of weeks.
Mm.
Instead of realizing that the public health reality is that living with a life-limiting illness, which is a broader term than dying, living with a life-limiting illness is a lifestyle. And it lasts not 2 weeks, but months, and sometimes years. Mm. Living with bereavement is not something that can be dealt with in 6 days or 6 weeks even. Bereavement, grief from bereavement, lasts forever. So the real question in public health is, what are our forever strategies to support people? When I first started saying things like that, people would say, well, Alan, you can't prevent death. Like, you know, I'm a bear with a little brain. And I would point out that it's not death we're working on here. It's what accompanies dying, what accompanies living with a life-limiting illness, what accompanies providing long-term care, what accompanies grief and bereavement.
Mm.
So anxiety and depression and social isolation and loneliness, and stigma, social rejection, job loss, lost school days, even worse things, sudden death that has nothing to do with what you're ailing from, and suicide. And all of these things are preventable. And if we can't prevent them, we can harm minimize them. And that's the whole point of a public health approach in palliative care. So that's how I came to it all. Mm. But since I did the public health stuff, which goes back 30 years now, a lot of governments and a lot of NGOs and a lot of professional associations in hospice and palliative care have picked this up and engaged me around the world. And so I help put policies together for different governments. And even in the UK government, as you know, in England and Wales, compassionate communities is part of ambition number 6, that every community has a role to play. And so the public health approach is meant to go beyond direct professional care, even beyond volunteers, but to complement and strengthen the palliative care system upstream and during and in that long winter of aftercare for those living with loss.
Mm. How is that manifesting either here in the UK or around the world? Examples of that in terms of, you know, you talked about volunteers and like, what does that mean at scale? What, in terms of a community, what is the scale of that community that we can have an influence and create a compassionate environment so that that dying is relocated back in the community rather than as a medical problem to be solved, fixed, or at least attended to? Do you see what I mean? Like, what are the examples of it, Alan, though?
Yeah, it's not either or.
Okay.
This is not an alternative framework for acute palliative care, not an alternative framework for hospices. This is a complementary framework. Don't forget that every healthcare specialism has this. So all we're doing is bringing it to PAL care. So, okay, what does this look like on the ground? So the two major examples, and they're not the only examples, but I'll start with these two, are compassionate communities and compassionate cities. Compassionate communities are neighborhood programs. Mostly they are neighborhood programs. So it's like a street, several street blocks, or a village, for example. In Shropshire, they have dozens of villages that are consider themselves compassionate communities. These are people who are able to identify in their community the people who are old and frail, people who are living with life-limiting illnesses or even life-threatening illnesses, people who are living with grief and bereavement. And they are able to provide them social support, if not directly, then to support their caregivers for example. People who are looking after people living with dementia or living with a serious cancer, sometimes they can go in and keep company, but more often they're supporting the caregivers, because caregiving for some types of illnesses can be 24/7. So, I mean, sleeplessness, for example, is a major problem for caregivers. And so often a community like a village or, you know, a couple of dozen city blocks will know that this is going on and be able to relate to the caregiver and say, you know what, I'll sit here for 2 or 3 hours. You go out shop or you go out and see a film, right? And people roster. People volunteer to be called after midnight and before 8 o'clock at night, right? So, but bear in mind, these are not hospice volunteers. These are ordinary members of the community. I often use the analogy of Neighbourhood Watch. You remember Neighbourhood Watch? Neighbourhood Watch was created because you couldn't have a cop on every street corner, right? It's not doable. So what the police suggested was a public health strategy that every neighbourhood takes some responsibility for not only surveillance but control. So you'd get a whole street or several streets, and they would have meetings once a month, and the police would come and give a little address, and they'd say, these are the crimes that have been occurring in your neighbourhood. These are the things you can make your house safer, the locks you should use, you know, the importance of using a dog, all of those kinds of things. And this was quite a big movement in the 70s and 80s when it first began, because we'd all been kind of socialised to mind our own business. Now, don't go looking in people's back gardens. Don't look in people's windows. Don't we? Avert your eyes, brothers. Avert your eyes. Well, Neighbourhood Watch was saying, no, don't avert your eyes. Look into your neighbour's garden on a regular basis. Look in their neighbour's kitchen window. And if you see somebody there that looks suspicious or somebody's climbing into a window, call the cops. This is a highly successful program. It's a global program. But it's a social program that's really about safety and policing. And compassionate communities is really also about not policing, but surveillance, being aware of your neighbours, being aware of the troubles that they might be experiencing, and not just looking, but acting, being able to go and offer a bit of support. These things are terribly important. So that's what compassionate communities are. Sometimes they're called compassionate neighbours. They're not volunteers. They're people like you and me in our own neighbourhoods doing these kinds of things. In compassionate cities, it's less grassrootsy. And we have, I think, half a dozen compassionate cities in the UK at the moment. I think there's about 30 worldwide. They're increasing all the time. They use a thing called the Compassionate City Charter. So it's a 12, 13-point charter that basically encourages an oversight committee, Compassionate City Committee, steering committee, if you like, of the who's who in a city. And they encourage workplaces to develop support policies for those environments. Trade unions have to have policies. Schools have to policies, faith groups, temples, churches, mosques, sporting clubs, footy clubs, tennis clubs, and it goes down. And it also requires the city to have a major public festival once a year. So, you know, we often have Veterans Day. In Australia, we have Anzac Day, and I think we have a similar thing here in the UK. People march down the street and they lay wreaths and so forth. And they remember the people who died. Take note, they remember the people who died. But they do so in the war. And the most of the people who die, even in any century, die in peacetime. And we don't have a festival to allow them to recognise they're dead. And so compassionate cities are cities that recognize that remembering our dead is everybody's responsibility, everybody's right, and everybody's comfort. We recognize the 95% rule. And that's the rule that says that dying people and grieving people spend less than 5% of their time in front of a doctor or a nurse or a counsellor or a volunteer for that matter. Mm. 95% of the time they spend alone or with family or with friends or with their dog, cat, their horse, the stereo system, the internet, the neighbours, fellow churchgoers, mosque worshippers. Therefore, public health has to be where all those places are. So support has to be follow people around as they move through the different social institutions in their city, in their neighbourhood, in their village. Mm. So they're two very specific ways in which this works on the ground.
I mean, I suppose in a way these were things that would have naturally occurred, eh? Because we didn't have palliative care. And in a way, before the NHS, we certainly didn't have a medical situation. And, of course, the care of the dying within hospitals has a mixed history, shall we say, and as medicine gained its dominance, death increasingly became seen as a failure and, medicine hadn't saved them, et cetera. So pre all of that, presumably the notion of compassionate communities, at least in terms of communities that cared for their own frail, sick, elderly, dying, we would have all had those skills. We're alienated from those skills, aren't we? We've professionalized, we've externalized, we've handed over those human skills to professionals. This is a call to arms to go back to a more organic sense of being human.
Yes, to some extent you could see it that way. It's certainly professional dominance is both. It's a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
I think there's always been a proportion of dying people who've had a tough time in the last 24 hours, last 48 hours, sometimes
longer, sometimes
a bit longer. There's always a proportion of dying people who don't go gently into that night.
Mm.
And so the professional work on that side of things has been a real blessing.
Mm.
And palliative care in that sense has been a true gift, a late 20th century gift. Medicine entering this fray, specializing in symptom science, has been a real blessing.
Mm.
We still haven't got it. We don't do it perfectly, but we do most of it well. Mm. And that's a really good thing. But in that hospice vision, for better or worse, palliative care claimed domain not only over physical problems, which it does very well, but the psychological, the social, and the spiritual. And there's the problem. There's the problem. By doing that, you're basically saying, I'll be there, like the AA, I'll be there anytime you call, which is not doable. And also not desirable, to be fair, I want to discuss my spiritual issues not with a stranger, but with a dear friend, someone close to me, if I was to do it at all. And I would want to probably do it sooner rather than later, because if there are any problems there, it's a lot harder to resolve these things in the last 24 hours than if you had, a year to go. Mm. So in that sense, public health has been a more organized attempt to bring social and spiritual and to some extent psychological supports to a very fragmented, poorly connected modern population in the late 20th and early 21st century.
Mm.
So I think it isn't going back because we're not what we used to be, and there's a hell of a lot more dying than people are used to seeing in the past, a much bigger aging population than people have ever seen before. And dying itself has changed. It's become not something that lasted a week or two. It's now very long.
Mm.
And the rise of sentimentality, of affections between strangers has become the major way in which we relate to each other. So kin has now sits alongside personal friendships and personal selection of mates, life mates, as importantly as family. So this means that we have to have a different approach to bringing people together. And it's been my argument that public health can help do that part well and to be a nice partner for clinical palliative care.
Yeah, great. You mentioned there the fact that that palliative care makes an attempt at trying to kind of encompass the physical, the psychological, the social, and the spiritual. I wonder whether I can use that just to launch slightly away from the more public health policy aspect of your work and look at the work contained in your book, Visitors at the End of Life, which can feel like quite a kind of shift of gear in that you look at near-death experiences. You look at them both from the proximally dying, those very close to dying, and visions, as it were. You talk about them as potential hallucinations or how they might be described, but some sort of vision, often of what might be an impression of the, I was going to say the afterlife, but the future life, I suppose, for the dying person, you know. You talk about them as people having visits from the dead, other people, you know. So I wonder, what was your fascination with that? And just as a second add-on to that, in it, you sort of claim a kind of agnostic position, I seem to remember, about whether these are in any way symbols or suggestions of an afterlife. And you see these as essentially social social events. And I mean, you're a sociologist, so I guess that's kind of you're going to be your angle. But what was your fascination or interest in them?
It's common for me to come across people that know about my public health stuff, but not have read or know about my books on dying, my work on dying. You're unusual that way, I have to say. And it also comes to me that people know and have read a lot of my stuff around dying, but I have a vague familiarity that there's this thing called compassionate communities that I've also have something to do with. It's not that common for people who have read both and to understand my history in these things. But as I said at the beginning of the interview, that's how I began and how I continue. My interest is in dying. It so happened through a twist of fate, part of politics of my career, that I ended up in palliative care, and I cobbled together a model of care that I understood from dying from a dying person's point of view. Because nearly all my work of study of dying is not is really what we call phenomenological. I'm interested in looking at dying from a dying person's point of view, not from the carer's point of view. That's a very different kind of experience. So I often say I study dying 6 months before death, 6 weeks before death, 6 days before death, 6 hours before death, and about 3 hours after the clinical determination of death. That is what I've been doing for 40 years as an academic. So if you believe that little narrative I've just described to you, then it's no surprise that I'm also looking at deathbed visions and near-death experiences and terminal lucidity and sort of peripherally anyway, visions of the bereaved, visions that people who are living with bereavement report. Bereavement visions are very, very high. If you know from my book, Visitors, I think the prevalence is somewhere between 30 to 70 to 80%, the higher figure for the Japanese. But even the lower figure here in Britain is still 30%. That's a lot of people report seeing or sensing their dead again after they've died. Near-death experience has a prevalence of around 20%. They're mostly, not always, mostly they are post-resuscitative experiences. And deathbed visions, we're still trying to get our head around the prevalence figures for that. But my estimate, based on my own studies, both in Moldova and in India, is 30%. The British study claims 10%. But the British study was interviewing people 10 days before death. And we know from other studies that the median time, the most common time that people have these perceptions of their dead around their bedside, is 2 days before death. And that suggests that the study in Britain was too early. And it's very difficult to do these kinds of studies. You can imagine the nightmare of getting through an ethics committee.
Ethics, oh my God.
Anyway, we won't go there. We won't go there for the moment. So I don't see myself as agnostic. You use the word agnostic with respect to the afterlife. I take my training very seriously. I'm a social science person. And it, both in visitors and experiences near death that preceded it, they are anthropological works. So visitors from the dead, if you like, near-death experiences, all of these things are thousands of years old. They're very old experiences. We seem to be flooded with them because of resuscitation, which emerged in the early 60s. But they have existed long before. I mean, the Greek, it's replete in the Greek literature and the Roman literature as well. We've got hunter-gatherer accounts of this kind of stuff. And it occurs outside experiences of death as well, or near-death. So what anthropology does is say, you know what, they may or may not be hallucinations. You know what, it may or may not be a window to the afterlife. But what we do know is that people treat them, and these things treat us, as social encounters. So what does it mean? What does that mean? What is the point of dead people coming to see us? And do they come like aliens in some kind of science fiction film or a horror film? Or do they come using a behavioral language, a language of social conduct, where it doesn't frighten us and that we recognize them as people we knew once? And why do they do that? What do they bring? Are there specific things that they come with? Do they give messages? What kind of messages are they? Why do they bring these things? What type of time do they choose to come and see us? Why didn't they come at Christmas? Why do they come on my birthday? Why do they come at night? Why do they come in the day? All these are legitimate questions, and they're not helped. They're not helped. Nothing is added by saying these are from the afterlife or these are hallucinations. And there is good medical reason to suggest that these are not hallucinations. And if they are hallucinations, and if we end up finding out they are, they're certainly what we would call special case hallucinations. They don't conform to what we currently understand as hallucinations. And I'll just add one more thing, which is very, very important for listeners to hear, is that we've had people who have had hallucinations from mental illness and who have had hallucinations from drug taking, and who have had near-death experiences. And those people claim that those near-death experiences don't resemble at all, experientially, the hallucinations they once encountered by using drugs or mental illness. So I think that says, for an existential comment, if I'm going to make an existential comment during this interview, I would say that's a hopeful thing, I think. That's a hopeful thing. But it's above my pay grade to say this is evidence for life after death.
Where are we at? Where are we at? And what's your hope for the next 10 years of palliative care and end-of-life care? Let's not talk about palliative care. Let's talk about end-of-life care. An eagle-eye view.
I would like to see end-of-life care move towards the same kind of public health situation that we see at the beginning of life. At the beginning of life, it's very diverse, and it's taken us probably the last, the last 60 years to build a comprehensive beginning-of-life public health strategy. And that begins with things like conception. So we have people who conceive of babies, no problem, and they go on and have babies. That's great. That's one thing. And we have midwives for that. We have obstetricians and all sorts of things. But there are people who are not that keen on that, and so they take contraception, and they want to be able to control when they have a baby. And so there's contraception, there's the pill. But lots of things can undermine the pill, a bout of diarrhea, being sick, anything. So some people get a bit paranoid and they decide condoms are going to be a good backup. But sometimes the pill and the condom doesn't work too well. And so you end up becoming pregnant. And so if that's the case, you know, sometimes the morning after pill could be a really good option. And so a lot of women rush down to the pharmacy and get a morning after pill. But some are not aware, and so you end up with a baby. Further down the track, you know, you're pregnant maybe 3 months, 4 months down the track. So some people decide, well, you know, I'm going to get an abortion. Okay, so we've got that. That's legal as well. So you can have an abortion. Some people decide, you know what, I'm not much for an abortion. I'm going to have the baby. But actually, I'm not ready for a baby. So what they do is they adopt it out. And that's totally legal. We have institutions to do that. And some people decide, well, you know what? I'll have the baby. I'm not going to adopt it out. But after a year or two, it's a nightmare. And so what they decide to do is to foster it out. And we have options for that too. All the way along, we have that situation. We often just think of one couple that has a child in a family and live happily ever after. You know, it's the kind of scenario that Walt Disney would have dreamt up in the 1930s. But in reality, that's not what life is like. And so we have a democratic society, a civilized society that understands not only social difference, but multicultural, multiracial, and different age issues as well. Don't forget there are some people who have fertility problems. So we have ways of dealing with fertility problems technologically as well. People can have children quite late. And we've even had that scenario where men have occasionally been able to have children. So we've got the whole panorama here. And it really does encompass the kind of society we are. I'd like to see that at the end of life. I'd like to see end of life be more than palliative care, and more even than assisted dying. I'd like different forms of support at different stages of different people involved. I would like to be able to choose. I would like my loved ones to be able to choose or to be offered different things at different stages. And I would like the option of changing my mind when and if I should decide to change my mind. I dream of an end-of-life care system worthy of our democracy.
Alan, I am aware of time. You've been extraordinarily generous. You have shared much. Is there anything that my limited questions haven't allowed you to share that you think, actually, you know what, in this situation, I'd like to have said that?
No.
Great. Now, it's either my questions were just so good or it's like, oh, come on, I need a cup of tea for God's sake.
And thank you for your question, Stephen. Very interesting.
Well, that was a very full episode. If I'm honest, I was a bit nervous about this one in particular. Alan is a major player in the world of end-of-life care, palliative care issues. You know, an authority, if you like, that he's worn very lightly, but a very serious and considered man. And I think that came across in the episode. You know, he knows his stuff very, very well. And I think it's a challenge. It's a challenge to many of us to be forced to think about particularly palliative care and hospice care and ways in which we can expand and extend that reach rather than feel a threat from what Alan has to say. So I was nervous, I was a bit anxious, but Alan was a very kind guest who spoke to his topic with, you know, ease. So thank you, Alan, and thank you for listening. If anything we've talked about in this episode has resonated with you, or if you're looking for support around grief and bereavement, you can find helpful resources on our website at ashgatehospice.org www.thebusinessbookshop.uk. And if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think and help us keep the conversation going. This episode was produced by Olivia Swift, and it's a Reform Radio production. I've been your host, Stephen. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time.